All right, very good. And I'm going to attempt to play this before I remember the hard time I had getting it going. Let's see if we can get it this time. And this is called Savior
From Myself.
From Myself. Of America. We're coming to you live from the National Religious Broadcasters Association Convention at the Opryland Hotel. And we're here. And a lot of things going on here. Matter of fact, I've got a fella here sitting across the table with me. His name is Ron, and I believe it's Busro. Is
that Busro?
Busro. Okay.
Yes.
Well, if there's a way to mess it up, that's what I'm going to do. But anyways, he is with one of the most important organizations on the planet, ladies and gentlemen, and that is the Salvation Army. Some of my favorite people. And, I'll tell you what. You really don't appreciate what it is for folks to have a commitment to reaching out with the gospel until you encounter one of the bell ringers prior to Christmas when it's, you know, like 0 degrees outside. And they're out there ringing the bell, or you run into a Salvation Army brass band playing out in front of a location. And boy, that used to be pretty common. I used to run into that all the time. And that is so impressive because it just sets the mood. I think that people, during the Christmas season especially, I think that there isn't any way a person cannot have a heart if they hear a Salvation Army brass band playing out in front of a store. And I don't know if y'all still do that or not.
Well, yeah, we do. And, you know, it's interesting you should mention Christmas carols, because my very first contact with the Salvation Army was as a bell ringer in New York City.
Really?
I was a student at Asbury College, now Asbury University, and someone came to the dormitory and said, "How would you like to go to work for the Salvation Army?" And so that Christmas, I went to New York City, stood in front of Lord & Taylor on Fifth Avenue, and rang the bell 10 hours a day, 6 days a week during the Christmas season. And that was my very first contact with the Salvation Army. Not only did I have a bell, I had a little microphone with a little opportunity to talk to people as they came by. And every year I go to New York and make sure I have an opportunity to say a little something, go over to Fifth Avenue and say to my wife, "Now, this is where I started with the Salvation Army."
Well, you know, that it's I guess we have grown accustomed to seeing the bell ringers, but I think that maybe folks overlook that when they're going into a store. It's hustle and bustle before Christmas. You only have a certain amount of time, and you have a certain amount of money. But when you stop and think of someone taking their, and I'm assuming that in many cases this is just their personal time that they volunteer to go there and ring those bells.
Many of them are volunteers, and I've talked to people who've volunteered for years. I remember during the Christmas season, a gentleman in Denver, Colorado, had volunteered for over 60 years as a Salvation Army bell ringer. And, of course, the important thing is that, you know, it started right here in the United States in 1891 out in San Francisco, the bell ringer. But you're worldwide. There are people listening to this possibly around the world. Salvation Army bell ringers are around the world. When I worked in Haiti for a number of years, we had Salvation Army bell ringers in Haiti, and it's an important part, but particularly in this country, it's so iconic with Christmas. And it gives people an opportunity to give and to help families who otherwise might not have a Christmas if it wasn't for the Salvation Army.
But that's not all that the Salvation Army does. I mean, I can remember in times of where there's been, I guess I want to say, disastrous weather conditions, that all of a sudden there would be a post set up. Maybe it's at a school. It could be a portable trailer or something. And there's the Salvation Army, and they've got hot coffee, and they're taking care of people. I don't understand how all that comes about. I don't even know how the brass bands come about. But you could share that with us. I mean, you folks are engaged in everything. When there's an earthquake, when there's a bad, horrible thing that's taking place, a natural disaster or something that goes on inside of a city or an an area, the Salvation Army is right there.
Yeah, well, the Salvation Army operates in every zip code in the United States. And so anytime there's a disaster, and you know, we have to think about disasters. You know, when a house burns down, that's a disaster for one family. The Salvation Army is there. When a tornado tears up an entire town, the Salvation Army is there to help them. And that's part of who we are as an organization. Our mission statement is very simple, to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and to meet human need without discrimination. And when people have lost everything in a disaster, that's certainly a human need that needs to be met. And the Salvation Army is there, and often working with the local community to make sure that not only the immediate need and needs of those who are affected by a disaster, but the long-term, helping those families recover on the long term. That's part of what the Salvation Army does. And the reason we can do it is because we're already there. We're already in every zip code. When I was working in Haiti, 2 days after the earthquake, the Salvation Army, I was living in Atlanta, but I flew back to Haiti, and the Salvation Army was there recently in the situation in the Philippines with the typhoon. The Salvation Army was there in Tacloban, already serving people. So it's not like we have to come in. We're already there helping people.
You know, I guess the thing of it is that you also at that you also present and make no bones about presenting the gospel. And the South, you know, you also have churches. You have churches located in a lot of different cities and a lot of different areas.
Yes, 1,200 churches in the United States.
Okay. Tell us about the churches. I mean, who attends the Salvation Army Church? I mean, we all get this impression that you have to be, you have to be a Salvation Army person to attend the Salvation Army Church. And you have, you know, I mean, well, you know, I mean, you kind of get this picture of people in uniform because y'all wear uniforms.
We wear uniforms.
Yeah. But there's another side to that, and I want you to talk to the folks about that. I mean, if you have a Salvation Army Church in your area, shouldn't folks visit?
Yes, people should come and visit. I've been an officer with the Salvation Army for over, well, in June will be 40 years. And it's interesting, most of that time I've spent as a Salvation Army pastor. And when I look out on Sunday morning, it's a great cross-section of people. Yes, there are people who are down and out, who feel very comfortable at worshiping at the Salvation Army. But there are also people who have professional careers, who work every day, who have interest in all kinds of things, but they see the expression of the Salvation Army as a place where they feel comfortable in being their church home, where they can do what they believe Jesus taught us to do. It's not just about loving each other, but if I love somebody, I ought to do something for them if they're in need. And that's what the Salvation Army does, and so that's why people feel comfortable. And if you're looking for a church home, the Salvation Army is there in communities all over the United States and really all over the world.
I guess what I'm saying is I think that folks maybe feel like if I go to a Salvation Army church, there better be a there has to be a specific reason as to why I would go there.
No. If you want to just come and worship, I was always very pleased when I was a pastor. I always was very pleased when people came on Sunday morning, and I think that's important. People, that point of contact on Sunday morning where people come. We want people who do more than just sit in a pew, but so often our commitment begins with sitting in a pew, being comfortable with a faith community, and then realizing that faith community can give me the opportunity to express my faith in a broader realm. And so that's what the Salvation Army does.
Okay, say a person comes to the Salvation Army Church, or they come to you and say, we want to volunteer and be a part of your organization. We
yes.
want to help.
Yes.
How do they go about that, and what is involved in that?
Well, I mean, we have so many different opportunities for people to volunteer, and every year I think we have somewhere like 17 million hours of volunteers. Over 3 million people volunteer with the Salvation Army, and that might be ringing a bell in front of a Walmart for a few hours, or couple of days during Christmas season. It might be helping out in a soup kitchen to serve the homeless. It might be working with families who need some help in figuring out how to manage their budget. It may be coaching basketball or football at a Salvation Army community center. So it's just about anything you can imagine as far as serving people. You have the opportunity to do that through the Salvation Army.
I'd like to touch on the subject of homelessness.
Yes.
It hasn't been too long ago that we had made a trip down to one of the bridges here in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely shocked at the cardboard box community down there. I had not seen this, you know.
Yeah.
So we started making it a habit of going down there and taking anything we could take down there. Blankets, food, whoever, you know, whatever we had. Matter of fact, that we had kind of made a deal with a couple of the local restaurants that when they got near closing time, whatever they would have, put that in some bags for us and let's take it down there. Mm-hmm. And we did this on a pretty regular basis. And then I had friends of mine say, oh, boy, you don't want to do that. You're going to get knocked in the head down there. Somebody's going to do something to you. Never ran into anything like that.
No, you didn't.
You know,
no.
Never, you know. And yet there was this fear, you know. They're down there in cardboard boxes. They probably have knives. They're going to come after you,
yes.
You know. And but you would run into people who were the furthest thing from being dangerous. You know,
yeah.
They were not. I suppose you've got dangerous people. We've probably got some dangerous people right here at the NRB.
I've seen a couple of them.
You know, but some of those folks, you could tell, some of them seem to be perfectly happy in their cardboard box house. And others, you could tell, they just didn't have 1 ounce of hope left in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that anything that I could have said or done would have motivated them. They were just glad to get a sandwich.
And, you know, I've worked with the homeless now for, you know, over 40 years. And one of the things that people say to me, well, you know, I would go out there and help them, but some of these people want to be homeless. And the fact is, I've never met anybody who woke up one day and said, oh, I want to be homeless. But what happens once a person becomes homeless, and we don't know if it happens 2 months or 1 month or 3 months or 6 months into that odyssey of homelessness, that they lose all hope of ever being anything but homeless. And so what they end up doing is they end up building defense mechanisms. So when you and I see them, it appears as though they want to be homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And they're comfortable with homeless. But the fact is, they don't see anything ever but being homeless. And so what they're doing is they've built up the defense mechanisms. What we have to do is, and you use the word hope, what we have to do is help them understand that there is the possibility of being something besides home, homeless, bringing them hope and help breaking down those defense mechanisms that's made it possible for them to survive as a homeless person living under a bridge in Nashville, Tennessee.
Well, the other thing I think that happens is that they become, they become survivalists.
Well, exactly.
And they're going to use survivalist tactics, even if you're handing them a sandwich, if there's something that they think they need to do to survive.
Sure.
You know, they're going to go down that road. And what I mean is, we had a building down on 8th Avenue, and I actually got to the point where the people would come around, and I would take, I'd set them down in front of a video camera, and I would just record their story. Tell me about your story.
Exactly.
Tell me where you came from. How did you wind up like this? You know, what are your capabilities? What can you do? What would you like to do if you could, and all that kind of thing. And I put those videos up on the internet,
mm-hmm.
and tried to get folks to look at them. And it worked out okay for a while, except when I'd run into one of those people, later they would forget the story they had told in front of the TV camera, and the story would change to something completely and radically different from what they had said the first time. So they had 3 or 4 stories in the bag that they could pull out at any given time. And I think the one thing that I realized then was that this is survival.
It's exactly right.
It's not evil. It's survival.
It's survival. Yeah.
And they've
building
learned.
It's building up walls, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't see any hope of ever being anything but homeless. And the better story that I tell you, then there's a chance that you might help me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens.
Well, I noticed that. And then on the other hand, we had we had a couple of them break into the building that we actually knew, you know, and whatnot. And but I still have to come back to the same common denominator. I don't think any of those people would behave that way or do anything if they had at least 1 ounce of hope.
That's exactly right.
It's all about hope. 1 ounce of hope, you know. And all it takes is one individual to open their heart and to try their best to give that 1 ounce of hope.
That's right.
You know. Mm-hmm. What about homeless people and in the areas that like, for example, housing? People come to you that have nowhere to go, have nowhere to live.
Well, we run a whole myriad of services with folks who are homeless. Of course, you know, people who are homeless can come in, and we have emergency housing programs all over the country. Probably the largest provider. We are the largest provider of emergency housing for homeless people. But, you know, providing a night or two or three or 2 weeks is not going to eliminate homelessness. And so we work very closely with state and local governments to particularly get families into a home. One of the things that we're seeing now is that we used to do this thing with transition, put people in transitional housing for a while. But what we're finding is that if a family becomes homeless, the sooner you can get them into what, at least in their minds, is a permanent home, then the chances of them becoming stable and moving out of that homeless situation into a much more stable environment and stable mindset happens so much quicker. And, of course, the important thing is to be sure to have caseworkers who work with them, who help them work through some of the issues, because it's never just a situation of, I couldn't pay my rent, so I lost my house. Most often there are other issues. And so working with those families, getting them in a home, and then working with them to help them build up the defense mechanisms that they need and give them the assets that they need, not just material assets, but emotional and spiritual assets that they need to overcome their problems.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, you see the rescue missions. Like we have one here in Nashville and places like in Chicago where you have Pacific Garden Mission, a rather famous.
Oh, yes.
You know. But the best they can do is a temporary thing, and they can put people up for an evening. But you know, I don't know. I think they set limits. It's like you can only stay here so many days, and then you have to move on.
That's right. Yeah. And we do that in a lot of our homeless programs. But we're finding that it's really more important with that person who really, after you've sat down and you've talked to them, you realize that there's some possibility here of them becoming something besides homeless. And giving them longer than a week or 2 weeks, but saying, here's a program. Get in this program for the next 3 months, for the next 6 months, and here's the plan that you and your caseworker are going to put together, and you work this plan, and you can live here for 6 months.
Well, I was wondering if it ever gets down to the members of the Salvation Army, people who belong to the Salvation Army, opening their home up to people and taking them in. Does it ever get to that point?
Or it does happen from time to time. Yes. Yeah.
Now, I've wondered about that because I've often thought, you know, some of us that wind up in extremely large houses for no good reason other than, in other words, I had to buy a home that was like five times the size I needed to get everything on one floor because my mom was near an invalid, and so many times I sit and think to myself, I think, well, you know, I've got all this square footage, mm-hmm. you know, and we've had folks come move in with us and
sure.
stay for periods of time,
yeah.
you know, but it's amazing how many people are absolutely unwilling to do anything like that. They're scared to death of allowing someone else to, you know. But I guess the way I look at it is the only reason I've got the house is it's something that God provided. If it wasn't for him providing the house, I wouldn't have it, you know. So,
and if a family was interested in something like that, they need to get involved with the Salvation Army, with the Gospel Mission, with another organization that might serve particularly homeless families. Get to know some of those families, and you will realize very quickly that these families are just like all of us, but a situation has arisen where they've ended up being homeless. And
well, you know, I went here in Nashville with a friend of mine, and I don't recall where it was now. I hasn't been that long ago, but I can't remember what the location was. But there was a number of families living in tents outside.
Yes.
You know, and so we went over and we were talking to him. He introduced me to this fella. And he had been working, and I can't remember the company either. They had folded. The company folded. And he had, his job was quite specialized. And he'd been looking for work and looking for work. And he had taken on a job working, I forget where it was. But anyways, they wound up losing their home. They lost their house. And obviously they lost cars before they lost houses. And, you know, he had obtained an old junk car. But he and his whole family were living in a tent here in Nashville. And he was looking for work every day. I mean, he was, you know, trying to find something that he could do. And looking in earnest. I mean, it was kind of funny. I mean, you think about it. You think, well, surely to heavens you can find something. Well, sometimes it's not that easy.
It's not as easy as people think. No.
So they wound up getting thrown out of their home. And now they're living in a tent in downtown Nashville, or somewhere right near the downtown area. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, you know, it doesn't seem to me, from meeting him and his wife and his kids, right next to them was a lady living there with two daughters that had lost her home.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm not getting the picture here somehow. Something isn't right. This is what, the U.S.? How can someone lose their job, then lose their house, and still not be able to find work? And they don't have relatives to move in. And how can they wind up living in a tent downtown Nashville? This just doesn't seem... This is the USA. This is not supposed to happen. You know, and the thing that goes through your head is, well, there's got to be more to this. There's got to be something really wrong. This can't be... But it is.
It is, and it happens all the time. There's a wonderful organization that has a chapter here in Nashville called 100,000 Homes. And it's designed for families like that to try to intervene. Of course, the best thing is to keep a family in a home. So, you know, pay their rent, help them for a while. But when they become homeless, the Rapid Rehousing Initiative, to get them into a home. And there are places here in Nashville where people who are building apartments or building homes will set aside one or two homes for this Rapid Rehousing Initiative called 100,000 Homes. And it really is a wonderful, wonderful program. And that's the key. We don't want anybody living under a bridge in Nashville or any place else in the United States. And let's get those families off the street.
Well, you know, I guess we've kind of talked in depth about quite a few things here. Let's get back to the Salvation Army. And I guess I bring that up because you folks work very close to this edge all the time. You're constantly dealing with homeless families, I am sure. You're dealing with folks who fall apart in hard times, and yet the Salvation Army is one of the very few ministries that actually rolls up their sleeves and does something about the actual problems that human beings face. And even if it's their fault, even if it's the fault of the person, maybe person's made a number of mistakes, winds up getting fired from his job, and he loses his home, and he's thrown into the street, and it's all his fault. Still, doesn't that individual deserve a second chance? Doesn't that individual deserve maybe another chance? That's probably a better term.
We all deserve 3, 4, 5, 600 chances, because God's love is boundless as the ocean. And the fact is that, you know, bad things happen to people.
Now, I'm going to tell you something that really, I think, makes a point for the Salvation Army. My son, Matt, was dealing with a lady with a couple of daughters that somehow, I don't know, I think he met this lady in a Kroger store.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in there, and all of a sudden he just felt he was supposed to buy groceries. So he did. And she had fallen on some hard times, not by any fault of her own, literally very industrious lady. And he got on the phone, and he called literally every church in the city of Hendersonville, Tennessee, asking if someone had some means to help her, either with child care or something. Not one church responded. Not one. And I thought to myself, well, what good are they? What are they even doing there? You know, there are big, beautiful buildings and all the carpeting and all the pews and, you know, the things on the wall and all the hand-carved wood grain this and wood grain that. And then you've got somebody in the city, you know, who is, as far as God is concerned, as valuable a human being as anyone else. And yet they don't have any time. Yeah. They don't have any resources. Why are they there? What's the purpose?
It is really one of the tragedies of the church. We often say, if the church did their job, there'd be no need for the Salvation Army. When William Booth founded the Salvation Army in 1865 in the slums of East London, if the churches had been welcoming and had said there is a place for those that you're rescuing from the street, the Salvation Army would never have evolved into what it is today. But it is tragic that people don't realize that there is significant need throughout this country. And for those of us, particularly evangelical Christians, we need to be engaged in what John Wesley called the acts of kindness, the helping of those who are in need. And we need to figure out how to do that. And, of course, we need to work together as churches. We don't always play well together, but particularly churches need to work together in meeting human need.
You know, not to change the subject from where we are.
One of my
favorite places is the Salvation Army thrift stores. I mean, you can find old Southern Gospel LPs. You can find old vinyl records that go back years, and some in impeccable condition.
Oh yes,
you know, and also you just never know what you're going to find in one of those stores,
And you never know what people are going to give you. I mean, it's always when I've run thrift stores as a part of our ministry, and you go in the morning and open up the box, and always amazed at the things that people give, but. Of course, the sale of those items goes back to help that local Salvation Army community meet the needs in that community.
Oh, yeah. And I guess the thing of it is, I would just tell folks that if you will take the time to go visit a Salvation Army thrift store, I will guarantee you one thing. When you walk out of that place, you'll have something in your hand that you just absolutely cannot live without.
That's right.
I'm telling you, it can become... I could see where if someone visited the stores on a regular basis, they might have to go through some sort of a 12-step program to get broke from, you know, visiting a thrift store every day.
Well, there are people who do get a little out of hand on those kind of things. There are people. It's interesting. There are people who visit some stores every day. And I remember in Fort Lauderdale, when we were in Fort Lauderdale, there was a man who came to the Salvation Army every day and went through the golf clubs. And every day he would look for a particular type of golf club. Mm-hmm. And every day that was part of his routine.
Well, I had another friend, and I can't remember now. I don't know where he's at today, but at the time he was living in Dallas, Texas. But anyways, he would go to a number of Salvation Army thrift stores. He would go in, and this is part of something he did. He just felt moved to do it. He'd buy up certain objects, things that he knew about, bring them back to the house, take pictures, put them on eBay. And when they would sell, he would take whatever he got out of that and take it back down to the local thrift store in the form of a donation. And
isn't that nice?
He did this on a regular basis.
Isn't
and he said,
nice?
You would not believe it. He told me, I think a person could make a living doing this.
People do.
You know, if they did it on a regular basis.
People do. Yeah, yeah. I remember when we were working in Haiti, and I used to see used clothes being sold on the street in Port-au-Prince, and there would be a tag on those clothes from a Salvation Army thrift store in Miami. And somebody had gone and purchased, usually they would buy them by the bale, because after clothes were in the store for, you know, a month or so, they would take them and then they would bale them. Somebody would buy that bale, ship it to Haiti, and then somebody would sell it on the street in Port-au-Prince.
That's a funny story. I want to thank you for coming by and spending time with us. And, of course, there's a Salvation Army, I want to call it maybe church, Salvation Army thrift store in every local area of every major...
Every zip code in the United States.
You know, so we want to encourage folks to participate in too. And if you want to find out more information, you do have a website.
We have a website, SalvationArmyUSA.org.
SalvationArmyUSA.org. But one of my very favorite organizations. And I'll tell you something. Christmas just would not be Christmas without the bell ringers.
That's right.
You know, it just really, you know, and I didn't ask this, but do you folks still do the brass bands?
We still have brass bands. As a matter of fact, right here in Nashville, there's a brass band. I live and work in the Washington, D.C. area, and we have a number of very nice Salvation Army brass bands made up of volunteers who attend Salvation Army worship services on Sunday morning and play the brass band. And during the Christmas season, we'll go out and play in front of the kettles and do concerts. So, yes, we have brass bands.
I'll tell you something. There's nothing like, you know, it being Christmas time and you're shopping and you run across a Salvation Army brass band. It makes you want to just stand there and listen and
shiver along with them.
You know, I don't know how they play those cold brass instruments
out
there.
Well, and sometimes it's so cold that they have to put something on the valves because the valves will stick.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Freeze up.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
And,
God bless you.
Hopefully we'll meet up again soon and get on the radio and talk some more.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd been convinced at that point that my life would be better dead than alive. Reason being is that my mother died when I was fairly young, and my father was an absentee father, and there was a lot of pain in our family's lives. So after a life of drug addiction for 8 years and being incarcerated 7 times, all small stays, nothing really big, I just felt that, you know, it's better I take my life because it has just been a mess, better to die than live. So I climbed on a bridge, got rid of everything. I threw my jewelry away, my money away, my bags, my clothes, my guitar, my boots, down to a pair of jeans and a shirt, climbed up on a bridge, ready to jump, looking at the trucks coming, the cars coming, trying to figure how fast they're going. And I just wanted a guarantee that I was going to check out, and I couldn't get it. I believe the Lord sent an angel to whisper to me. And the message, you would have thought the message would have been, well, Tony, don't jump off the bridge because Jesus died for your sins. That just wouldn't have worked at that time in my life because I was filled with hate and rage for Jesus. I blamed him for the death of my mother and the absence and death of my father. But this impression I got was, Tony, if you jump here and the truck or car tries to get out of the way, cut your legs or arms off, what are you going to do then? You know, going through life with more pain. I knew that was a possibility, so I got off the bridge. I wandered into the gutters of Skid Row. It was December. It was cold. Now I've got no clothes, no shoes, nothing. I'm freezing in Chicago, and I start crying out to God in the middle of the street, not verbally, but in my heart, saying, God, show me who you are, and I'll tell people from this day forward who you are. And as soon as I finish my sentence, a man steps out of a building. He points right at me and says, do you need a place to sleep and some food for the night? I needed both, so I went inside of that building. It was a Salvation Army building. And they gave me my bread, my bologna, a bed to sleep on. I went into the chapel. While I was in the chapel, I started to say, God, who are you? What is your name? I don't even know how you did this. But don't leave, whoever you are. And while I'm in that chapel and asking God who he is and asking him 4 questions, the derelicts invited into the mission for a bed and a meal start singing the answers to my questions. I had 4 questions. I had 4 answers. By the time that program was done, I knew that Jesus Christ had died for my sins. But I still, even with all that revelation and information, still didn't know what to do with it. So I went up to the chaplain at the end of the program and I said, God has spoken to my heart tonight, but I don't know what to do. And he looked me right back in the eye and said, you know you're a sinner? I looked him back in the eye and said, sinner? I had no problem with that. He says, do you know Jesus died for your sins? I said, sure. He fell the first time, second time, third time, got nailed to a cross. He said, do you know he rose from the grave for you? I said, I sure do, as he's been speaking to my heart tonight. And I put my faith in the shed blood of Jesus Christ that night. My life has never been the same since that very moment.
Well, that's an incredible story, incredible testimony. So where has that led you?
Well, right away, I was so excited about the change, and I felt peace in my life for the first time ever. But I just wanted to go back to the people that I could identify with, and that was, basically drug addicts and people who were in prison. And I wanted to tell them, hey, there is hope. There is hope. You know, this thing about Jesus is real. And so I just started doing that immediately. And that goes way back to 1971. Just started sharing my faith. And, you know, I just read a book about the Chinese, the growth of the Chinese underground church and the church in Korea. And these people, when they got saved, they started sharing their faith right away. They didn't go out and get a Bible degree. Not that I'm against these things. It's just that we need to tell what Jesus Christ has done for us. We have a story to tell. We have a testimony, no matter how drastic or how not drastic it is. We have to tell about what he has done for us. So I started doing that. And basically, I was in a prison one time, and I had my Bible in my hand, and about 75 guys came forward at the end of the program. I didn't have any materials to give these people. I had nothing. So I started tearing pages out of my Bible and giving it to them, say, here, take this back to your cell. It's the Word of God. And through that, the Lord showed me a mission field and said, Tony, I want you to do this. I want you to minister to prisoners. And I felt incredibly inadequate because I just came off the streets of the gutters of Skid Row, and I was real young in the faith, and I was talking to trees a few months ago. So I took that to heart. I went home, read one of the pen pals that I was writing to, had two pictures of little boys he had. I had little kids at the same time. His letter said, Tony, I'm so tired of being tired, it ain't funny. And I sensed the desperateness and the depression that I could so easily identify to. And I saw the little children, his boys, and that. And my heart just went out to him. Then I read a newspaper the next day titled, Bergen Record, titled Prisons, Warehouses of Human Lives. And I've been going in and out of prison, so I know what that meant. I've seen that. And then the Lord led me to the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Luke about putting the Lord first in our lives and being like a wise builder, consider the cost. Because I knew the Lord was calling me into missions and to particularly the prison ministry. So I went away that weekend, and I prayed, and I said, Lord, help me. And the Lord led me into prison ministry. That calling is what kept me in this work for 42 years. It's been an amazing, amazing journey. And the lives that we've seen transformed in prisons is just breathtaking. And not for number's sake, but you know, we've had the pleasure of sharing with over a million inmates the glorious message of the gospel of Jesus Christ, seen over 100,000 that we know of. By them coming forward, raising their hand or whatever, and put their faith in Christ. Who knows how many others there were? But not that numbers are important. But what's important is that that little seed that took place at a rescue mission by somebody reaching out to me has had that great impact. And I don't know if they even know that. It's just the power of God and the importance that we need to be sharing about his love. We also work in Cuba, and we work with bikers. The three areas of our ministry are prisons, bikers, and Cuba.
Okay, now, let me ask you a question. Ministering in prisons. What differences are there? What do you find when you look at folks who minister on the outside world to where you're ministering in prisons? How is it different? What do you find ministering inside of prisons?
Well, there's a high degree of hopelessness. I mean, you're dealing with people that 60% of our audience, for example, are in for life. They're never going to see the outside world. Chuck Colson put it this way. He says the prisoners are the poorest of the poor. Many of them have to still be a father or a mother while they're in prison. I mean, the logistics change, but you're still dad. Nothing's going to change that. You're still mom. Nothing's going to change that. And what our ministry does is we try to address some of these issues with the inmate. You know, you're still dad. The logistics are changed. It's a little bit more difficult, but you're still dad. You need to have an influence on your children. So we try to deal with that. It's much more complicated than the outside world. There's lots of complicated finances. You don't take no love offerings in no prisons. You know, we're faith-based ministry. We rely on the donations of people, churches, and businesses to resource us to do what we do. Last year, we did 182 programs. It costs a lot of money to do that. So you don't take an offering like a church, so that's a significant difference. The greatest battle, I think, and it's one that we're dealing with right now with the release of a new DVD that we just released called The Church Behind Bars. The Church Behind Bars started to organically grow in the early 1990s. And what caused that was economic cutbacks, where the chaplaincies lost their assistant chaplains, all their supportive staff, and he had the last standing chaplain being faced with 1,500 members, in a sense, of his congregation. That's his audience, is the inmate population. And he had to go to the administration and say, listen, in order for me to run an effective chaplaincy program, I need to have some help here. So they assigned orderlies. Through the orderlies, the organic church started to grow in the early 1990s. That church has gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. And I guess the main difference here is that we in the outside world don't recognize the church behind bars. We go in there to minister to them, like we do in foreign countries. We're going to go minister to them. And I say, you know, let's stop this. God bless the people that do it, but let's stop this. And let's start to go into our foreign countries, into our prisons, and let's look for the organic church behind bars, and let's empower and encourage them to do what God's designed them to do, because they can get to the back corners of the prisons that I could never get to with all the programs in the world. I'm not going to be able to reach those people. It's their job. It's their assignment. But it'll never happen until we on the outside world acknowledge them and empower them and encourage them. Go do it. And the impact of that when they come out of the prisons, and you know, the other 40% that come out of the prisons, they'll be able to identify with the local church because they're functioning as a local church behind bars. So this new DVD that we're pushing here is just incredible in terms of creating some paradigm shifts in the way we do prison ministry in our nation.
I guess the question is it people who are behind bars and for extended periods of time, you know, losing hope of ever getting out of those, mm-hmm. you know. And I wonder at that point, how can we effectively give those folks hope in order to hang on? I mean, does it and should it come from the outside world? Shouldn't churches here on the outside be very, very instrumental in working with folks in prison to give them hope? Not necessarily to go in there like, well, hey, all of you heathen prisoners here, we're coming in here to minister to you, mm-hmm. but to provide them something, mm-hmm. you know, to give mm-hmm. them hope and purpose in Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that faith cometh by hearing and hearing by the Word of God, and it's important that we do share that with the prison community and to bring that hope. I mean, I was hopeless. There's nothing more hopeless than wanting to take your own life. In prison or out of prison, there's nothing more hopeless than that because you're done. So, and the Lord, the hope of the gospel transformed my life. It's the same hope that they need, and it's only found in the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not found anywhere else. So we do need the church on the outside. But the problem is this. I believe one of the problems is this. We have not recognized the church behind bars. We look at them as inmates. I don't want to go near them. I'm not going. You can go into prison, but I ain't going into prison. And that's the way we look at it. So I think our perception of what God's doing behind bars has to change. And I think with that, we'll find more volunteers willing to go in because they'll recognize they're going in with the church. So I think the key, again, is the church behind bars, empowering and encouraging them. They can share the Word of God. They can share the message of hope. Who is better qualified to lead another inmate to Christ than an inmate who's already come to Christ? There's nobody better qualified. So, but at the same point in time, we're reminded, when I was in prison, you visited me. When I was in prison, you came. And in Matthew, when it says, when I was in prison, you came. So we need to be able to fulfill our responsibility. We need to be able to treat the prisoners as though we were a prisoner. And I know if I was a prisoner, my expectation of the church would be to come here and maybe talk a little bit and have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. Maybe you can't do that in the prison, but you could shake hands and share the love. You know, say, hey, how's your family doing, and pray with one another. I mean, there's powerful things we can do. But the hope of the gospel is the key to transforming a person's life.
Well, I was thinking that more than likely it could be that the church behind bars could be something to minister to young people who are not behind bars.
Absolutely.
They would probably be more qualified than the local church that they maybe belong to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I get the impression, though, that once you are in with a group of people behind bars that are part of a church or an organization that they've kind of formed there, studying, worshiping, and doing all the things that they do, I would believe that those folks are probably more serious than us folks on the outside.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, when you have nothing but your faith, you don't have all the distractions that you have on the outside world. It's very different. Even our work in Cuba, when I first went to Cuba in 1999, there were not half the distractions they have today, and the Holy Spirit worked in a different way. You get the same thing behind bars. And there is, I got a letter from a guy this year, and he said, you know what we did New Year's Eve? He said, we gathered around. We had 60 men in our dorm, and we put the guards in the middle, and right when it came up to midnight, we prayed over our guards. I mean, that's going on behind bars. I have other inmates that say, you know what we do at 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock break in the yard when all the guys are out in the yard selling their drugs and doing all their stuff? We have our Bible studies out on the benches, and we got a great thing going there. Fabulous stuff that's going on behind bars. I mean, incredible stuff.
I want to shift gears on you here, though.
Sure.
Because I know, and I want folks to have a contact information on your prison ministry as to how they can help and support and whatnot, and maybe even get involved in it with you in some way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But you mentioned you were doing stuff in Cuba, and I'd like to know, what in the world are you doing in Cuba?
Well, in Cuba, we do bring teams, and I've been bringing teams into Cuba since 1999. Our function in Cuba is to empower the local church and to work with the local church. We've made a shift in Cuba, as well as we've made a shift in the prison community that I've been discussing here about empowering the organic church that's existing there. We've done the same thing in Cuba. But what we're doing now, for example, this trip I'm leaving on Friday, we're bringing in humanitarian aid. Some clothing, some guitars, some musical instruments for worship teams. I've got a nutritional grant that I'm bringing in for 325 children for 6 months. We're setting up for the first time 3 medical clinics of many that we'll be setting up in the country. And we bring in Spanish literature, DVDs. Actually, I could use all the Spanish DVDs I can get my hands on. We have a cafe where we're allowed to show Christian DVDs 24 hours around the clock right on a bus station, and that's a powerful opportunity to share the gospel. So basically what we do in Cuba, and we got 3 construction projects that we're working on. One is a pastor's house, and 2 are some local people that lost their homes. So we're involved in construction projects, humanitarian aid, medicines, teaching and enabling the local church. We got a lot of youth programs that we're doing, and we do a lot of house-to-house visits, praying for people, sharing our faith, and just encouraging people in the Lord. Well, that's pretty much what we're doing in the country of Cuba. And we invite volunteers to come with us. They don't have to speak Spanish.
Well, see, I don't know anything about Cuba, but how do you get in and out of the country?
I had a OFAC license from our government that allowed me to fly directly from Miami. They changed the OFAC laws, so we don't have to renew the license every year anymore. But I just people go right on my letterhead. We fly directly from Miami, and we're perfectly legal. We have no problems getting into the country, no problems coming out of the country.
Well, what do you find in Cuba? Because, we hear mixed reports about different things, and I hear that Cuba is extremely poverty stricken, and then I also hear other reports that different parts of Cuba are not that way at all, that it's just like what we have here in the States. So, who do you believe? Who do you listen to?
There are 2 Cubas. The locals, average income is $12.50 to $15 a month. So if the people think that that's wealthy, then they've got another thing to think about. Is there wealth in Cuba? Well, there's always those extremes of wealthier and not wealthy, but nothing like what I think people are thinking of here. Government people have a little bit more to work with. Military has a lot more to work with. But the locals are extremely poor, and they don't have literally anything. When I first went there, they didn't even have pencil and paper and dirt floors, and we built some kitchens and stuff like that. All the buildings are crumbling. They're falling apart. Now, as far as the military is concerned, they've been building brand-new military buildings. I'm surprised when I went in last trip to see how many they have built, and the Chinese are pumping enormous amounts of money into the country all of a sudden. They're building a new railroad from one of the ports into Havana. So there are some things going on in Cuba that are pretty interesting these days, but far from being wealthy, no, they're not. They're struggling. The only reason that they're opening up the gateway, in my opinion, to cell phone, why would you give a local an opportunity to have a cell phone when he only gets paid $15 a month and it costs $1 a minute for a cell phone? Why would you do that? It costs $75 because they're relying on the outside world to send money in and resource it. It's all economics driven. Why would you allow them to buy a house? It's all economic driven. There are some changes going on like that in Cuba, but it's driven more, in my opinion, from what I see, it's driven more by economy than is being driven by human conditions, that we suddenly have a heart for the poor. You know, no, it's poor in Cuba. It's extraordinarily poor in Cuba. And people do not have nearly what they need to survive on. You spend your day in Cuba trying to figure out what are you going to feed your family tomorrow. And make no mistake about that. It's difficult.
And does that apply for, I would say, what percentage of the population? 80%, 70%, 60%? How does that?
Well, I couldn't give you a direct answer on that because I don't know what percentage are military and government personnel today. But I would say in terms of the locals, it includes them all. There's no locals in Cuba that I know that are doing well because it's prevented. You know, Cuba doesn't want people to be able to have enough resources to not think about survival, because then they'll start thinking about other things that the government really would prefer they don't think about. So there is that concern. You know, it's always been driven by a divide and conquer mentality. I don't think that has shifted or is going to shift anytime soon. The only thing that can change this situation is economics, and that might come just like it did in Russia, where the economic pressure just gets so intense.
You also work with bikers, you say. I'd like to hear this.
Yeah, we work with bikers. We do. I do the Bikes and Blues Festival out in Kansas, Daytona Bike Week. I'll be doing that right after this Cuba trip. I get a day off, and then we go there. We set up a stage called Music for the Soul, and we perform every day, sometimes two concerts a day. But the Music for the Soul stage provides Christian concerts for 10 to 12 hours a day, and we're right across the street from the Iron Horse in Daytona Beach. Then we head over to, that'll be the 9th to the 15th of March this year. After that, we head out to Sturgis, South Dakota, the largest bikers rally in the United States. They average about 750,000 bikers there. Same thing, Music of the Soul sets up a stage. We have international and national performers come in. We share the gospel. It's a very, very, very fast-moving environment there. You know, they're just riding past the stage. But we also go and walk through the streets. We'll go down to Main Street, down by the Hells Angels. They have their area down there. We'll be praying over people and encouraging them and just anointing people and praying. And it's fabulous. We give thousands and thousands and thousands of free CDs away, Bibles, tracts, books. We even open up our food. We have a food a facility where we feed people. People need food. They can come in and get some food. And then we have a lot of one-on-one that goes on in the streets, a lot of workers that work the streets.
So you're in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of your ministry is Solid Rock Ministry. Mm-hmm. How can folks get a hold of you? You're doing so many different things. I don't know how they could find you sitting still for a minute here.
Well, so. I'm on the road 182 days last year, so it is hard. But we have a staff. I have an office. They could reach us on the website by going to www.thesolidrock.org. And they can look us up there. We do take mission teams in, not only to Cuba and not only to the bikers' work that we do. We take them into prisons. And there's no pre-qualifications here. All you have to do is have a willing heart. And we like to connect with churches and provide a conduit for smaller churches that don't have an outlet for their people to serve in the Great Commission and reach out to people that need to hear the gospel. So we like to develop relationships and partnerships with churches and be able to do that. We are a musical team, so we do a lot of music. But I let people share testimonies and teach, and depending on what their skill levels are. But just to come in and be on the chow line, shake hands and give a track, and be part of our hospitality group means a lot to the inmate community. So there's lots of opportunities for people to serve. We need people on our prayer team. We have a good internet prayer team. All people have to do is go to pray, P-R-A-Y, the number 4, S-R-E-A, at yahoo.com. They can get on our internet prayer team, and that's where they get the hottest information coming off the plate for the Solid Rock Ministry, what our next trips are, where we're going, et cetera, et cetera. Or get on our database, get our hardcore mailing list.
Well, listen, I thank you much for stopping by and sharing with us. And now folks know how to get a hold of you.
Mm-hmm.
And to go up to the website and look it over, and also to support your ministry.
Yeah, we could use that for sure. You know that DVD, by the way, The Church Behind Bars, there's a link right on our website. People want to see what God's doing behind bars. They can click that. If they want to see what they would do, they can click it too, because they'll get a good idea of what they would do.
Well, very good. Very, very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good. It's good hearing, especially your testimony and all the other things that you're doing to reach out, touch lives, change lives, and get the gospel forefront in people's lives. Thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you.
This is National Religious Broadcasters Association Convention in Nashville, Tennessee, at the Opryland Hotel. This is radio station WTWW, coming to you on international shortwave from the United States of America. Coming to you from Nashville, Tennessee, Music City, USA. We're at the Opryland Hotel, and this is the National Religious Broadcasters Convention 2014. And we're here broadcasting, and, of course, we've got a lot of music, a lot of guests coming on. So keep your radio tuned right there. We're going to be here for the remainder of today and as well as all day tomorrow. But before we do anything else, I got a gentleman I want you to sit down right here, if you would, because I know this guy. And I don't know, David, you're talking to this fellow, but you guys continue your conversation. But I want to say hello to Don here. I was... very, very young radio guy, and I mean from, I don't know, back in the, well, I don't know what year it was. Must have been in the, let's see, I was, what year would it be? I can't even think. Probably 69, 70, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I was about 13 then, but no, not really.
Well, the only thing I know is when I was working for WMUZ in Detroit and WBFG, and I don't know which of the stations it was that ran Afterglow, but it was one of them.
Right, right.
Maybe both of them.
It could be, but I remember that, yes.
What call letters do you remember, though? I mean, do you remember WMUZ or WBFG?
I think it was WMUZ.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I remember Afterglow did run on WBFG.
Yeah. Right.
And the reason why is because MUZ was mono, and BFG was stereo, and okay. Afterglow sounded really nice in stereo.
Yeah, it was, and it's still in stereo. Uh-huh. I'm still producing it. Mm-hmm. It's on about 100 radio stations around the country and around the world. Mm-hmm. I just added a station, of all places, in Moldova, the old former Soviet Union republic. And I've just been thrilled that God continues to take the music and the comments, and stations want to play them.
Well, you know, for the folks that may think they're familiar with Afterglow,
yes.
Why don't you give us one of your the typical introduction to the Afterglow program? And that I know is going to ring some bells in some folks' head. Just go ahead, take as if you were coming on live.
Okay. Hello, this is Afterglow, and I'm your host, Don Johnson. Join me for this next half hour. We'll have music of today and yesterday. Music that'll give you a little calmness in the chaotic and confused day of our society. So let's now listen to Ralph Carmichael as he plays How Great Thou Art.
Now, there's a name I haven't heard in a while.
Well, Ralph was actually the inspiration for Afterglow. He put out an album, and it was his orchestrations and choral arrangements of the great songs, the great hymns of faith. And it was the kind of thing that was so spectacular, most stations didn't even know about it. And so I said, this is the kind of music we need to get on radio. And so I created Afterglow under the inspiration of what he did. It was called Sounds of Faith, his CD. LP back then. And so it's been great. Yeah, you're using LP still.
Well, I remember yeah. Ralph Carmichael Strings, Ralph Carmichael.
Yes.
I mean, all kinds of things.
Exactly.
And then there was other groups that it seemed like Ralph Carmichael and the 16 Singing Men.
That's right, yes.
And all these different ones. And they were on, what, Zondervan or Word Records? I don't know which.
Yeah, I think it was Word. Yeah.
And that was quite the thing, because I remember a couple of instrumental albums, they had pictures of timpanis on the front, which you never saw a timpani in a church anywhere. You know?
No,
you know?
That's true. Well, what I've tried to do, reproduce in Afterglow, is I will take traditional hymns that people have known and sung and loved for years. But I look to find very interesting arrangements. grand orchestrations or a special touch of violin and cello or whatever it might be that takes that song and just shoots it right above what you ever would have dreamed it could have been like.
There's a gentleman here somewhere, and I'm sure he's wandering the floor, but he came by the booth a little earlier before we were on the air, and I'm sure that not only would he remember you, and I don't know, he may be affiliated with stations now that would play Afterglow, and that's a fellow by the name of Hank Hoot. I don't know if you know Hank at all.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was in Detroit. We were teasing him earlier because they coaxed me into doing one of these Boblo cruises.
Yes.
On WBFG, nice. Where we had to stand on top of the boat and aim the antenna back at the station as they broadcast going down the Detroit River, you know.
Oh, my.
And so I was teasing Hank when he came by here, and I said every time I ever saw Hank when he was young man, he always had some cute girl on his arm, you know. And these were relatively attractive ladies, and you would say to yourself, how in the world did Hank come across this line? And as soon as I said that, of course, he started laughing. He turned very red. But WBFG, now you see, MUZ was more noted for Southern gospel music.
Yes, right.
And BFG was more, I was expecting to hear Gloria Rowe and Frank Boggs and...